If you see your partner like spending a lot, it might license you to do the same. And you say, oh, well, if they're spending, you know, a little bit more freely, well, then maybe I can too. But it could also go the other way where it leads into compensatory mechanisms. So like if I see my partner spending a lot, I might think, oh, well, I better like reel them in or pull back my own spending. And so I think our partner's spending almost becomes an anchor for our own spending.
Welcome back to the Most Hated F-Word podcast. I am delighted you are here for another fascinating conversation. My name is Sean Maslick, and today my guest is Dr. Jenny Olson. Dr. Olson is an assistant professor of marketing at Indiana University's Keller School of Business. Dr. Olson focuses on the interplay between money and couples, how our decisions are made, the dynamics that unfold, and how often we fail to recognize as couples how to have better communications around money. Her research looks at different bank account structures. Should you have joint or not joint bank accounts? Financial infidelity, and many other areas that affect the relationships we have with money and within our coupleships. This was an enjoyable conversation as we really dove into the dynamics that couples have when trying to navigate financial decisions. Dr. Olson also talks about the importance of perceived control and how it plays a significant role in influencing our financial decisions within relationships. And of course, Dr. Olson really talks about the importance of open communication and transparent communication when it comes to money conversations with our partners. While we know this intuitively to have open and transparent conversation, the fact is, in reality, it is often not practiced. And Dr. Olson talks about the impacts this can have on the relationship.
Talking gives you confidence because there's transparency. I have all of the information that I need, and I think talking about it gives you a sense of control because all that information is out in the open. And then that helps you move forward together and be tolerant of, you know, small setbacks because you have that more confidence and that helps you weather the storm.
This was a fantastic conversation. Whether you are in a coupleship or not, the ideas and principles apply to everybody. Before we get into this conversation, if you have been enjoying this podcast, if you've been listening to it, I'd like to ask a favor. If you can head over to Apple Podcasts, it only takes a couple minutes, and leave a review, that would be great. Or share this episode with a family, friend, or colleague, someone who you think would enjoy this conversation. And now, I hope you enjoy this fascinating conversation with Dr. Jenny Olson. Dr. Olson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am excited to dive into this emotional, sensitive, taboo, all of the above conversation on financial decision-making within partnerships, coupleships, and so many other influences. Something that I feel impacts all relationships, coupleships, and beyond, but yet we don't talk about it enough. So I'm happy you're doing the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. And it is something we don't talk about enough. And so I'm glad that we are breaking that taboo down today.
Something that I enjoy doing on the podcast is diving into the guests, a bit of their story. I think stories are extremely important to share as it helps convey a topic, but kind of on an emotional or a basis that we start to reflect on our own lives. So mm-hmm. I'm curious, what made you study this sensitive topic, this topic that many people, and some of your research even talks about why, say, financial infidelity, which we'll get to, hasn't been researched so much. What got you into researching this hot topic?
It started out when I was a child, actually, growing up in a very working class family. And I remember my parents sitting at the kitchen table doing the bills and just kind of observing them. And, you know, not to divulge too much about my parents, but my dad is definitely a spendthrift and my mom is definitely a tightwad. And so they would always argue about, you know, spending and saving. And I just witnessed that growing up. And turns out there is research by Scott Rick and colleagues that finds that we do tend to marry our financial opposite. So people that spend more than they, you know, would like to tend to marry people that spend less than they would like to. And it creates that tension. And so fast forward to my PhD program at the University of Michigan. And at the time I was interested in studying sex and sexuality in couples. And I realized that that wasn't really a marketing topic as much because I'm in the marketing department. And so I always joke, I went from one spicy topic to another of money. And I was engaged at the time. And I remember thinking, you know, my fiance, he was like, we should join accounts. And I was like, no, we're not doing that. I like my autonomy. And then like the good little scholar that I am, I went to the literature and I'm like, well, what does the research say on this? And it quickly became evident that there wasn't a whole lot. And my advisor, Scott Rick, at the time, we just started talking about it and we got really interested in this area. And that my whole body of work really developed from those early conversations. So I'd say it's just one of those things that I observed as a child and just really came to be intrigued by, because to your other question, a lot of the financial decision-making research is conducted at the individual level. But my whole thing was, yeah, but a lot of these impactful financial decisions are made in concert with somebody else, you know, in the context of relationships. And so I decided to tackle this very difficult topic, and here we are.
Marrying our opposite, it seems that we're setting ourselves up for a lifetime of, I'm looking for the right word here, a lifetime of questioning each other's decision or financial decision making.
100%. So opposites attract with in the case of money, and it does predict lower financial harmony. Like partners just aren't on the same page as much. And, you know, it can and cause tension and arguments.
Opposites attract. Is there a silver lining? If we do the work, does it seem to allow us to see each other's perspectives more and become a more empathetic person?
I think part of the reason that it's believed that we were attracted to our financial opposite is if we dislike that part of ourselves and we seek it out in someone else. So like if I'm, you know, really tight with money, I almost want someone to help loosen me up a little bit. And so that's why. And I think, you know, it can cause rifts, but it can also provide a nice opportunity for conversation and help you get on the same page and, you know, align your financial goals and then ultimately move forward together.
So this last part you said, move forward together, I think is a key part of that sentence, because obviously if we're not doing it together, we have dysfunction and arguments and so forth, which I would assume everybody listening to has experienced that at some point in time. When it comes to partnerships, you've done some work on perceived control or subjective knowledge when it comes to financial capability or just the amount of knowledge someone has in around money. How, if anything at all, does this impact the influence that person has on financial decisions in the relationship? And when I say that person, the person with maybe higher perceived or objective financial knowledge.
This research we recently published, and it was part of my dissertation, and we looked at how couples make financial decisions together. And on the surface, you might think, oh, well, the partners are going to rely on the person who knows more. And so that would be financial literacy or what we call objective financial knowledge. But knowing what to do is different than thinking you know what to do. And so confidence, subjective knowledge, can ultimately have a really strong impact in the context of relationships. And we did some pilot studies where we asked people to make inferences about their partner's level of literacy. Like, how much do they actually know? And it's not just what they know that predicts that, it's our perception of their confidence. And so we brought couples into the lab and we looked at these dynamics, and we do find that even above and beyond literacy, partners are really relying on the partner who has greater subjective confidence. And the reason is because, well, some potential mechanisms are things like they tend to talk more. So we measured their airtime during the discussion, and, you know, people that, you know, think they know a lot tend to talk a lot. And so we find that that's the dynamic in partners. And so my father-in-law is a retired financial planner, and he often mentioned this when couples would come into the office, you know, there might be one person who's doing all the talking and has greater perceived knowledge in some sense, but then they never come back because they're not maybe the one that's ultimately driving it at home. And so it is important to get both partners on the same page, but we do see that this confidence piece does matter. And I would argue that they both things matter. You know, we need both literacy and confidence.
It's interesting. So I'm hearing you say the person who has this more confidence might come across as more capable. It makes me think of the behavioral bias, the Dunning-Kruger effect, where like the least you know, the more confident you can be in something.
Right.
Is it difficult to then
harmonize those conversations when that confident person is like, no, I know this. And maybe the other individual is just sitting there silent. And I guess you can have two different personality types where that silent person or that person who feels like maybe their voice doesn't matter might just concede, or they might try to get their voice heard, but it sounds like it might be difficult if this confident person doesn't listen.
That's true. So like unfounded confidence in some ways. And so we find that financial literacy and financial confidence are correlated. So if you score 13 out of 13 on a financial literacy quiz, you probably guess I got all 13, but not always. Like you said, there are situations where, someone is essentially full of hot air. But the nice thing about relationships is that the other partner can see through that. Like we've had multiple conversations together, like I know that you're full of it kind of a thing. And so, I think that that's less common in this case because of couples. They have that intuitive, that knowledge of each other over time.
Mm-hmm. So based on your research and what you really found on this financial control and financial decision-making, how do couples start to, bring the equilibrium to a neutral stance? And maybe that doesn't mean that they're both making one for one financial decisions, but more or less they feel like, hey, my voice is being heard in this financial decision. It's not like I'm going to bed thinking that person has more financial control over me.
Yeah, that's where I think just having conversations are really important. And I know it's super easy to say, oh, we'll just talk about money. It's really challenging, but I think it's one of those things where you make a concerted effort to make sure both partners' wishes are being heard and that one person's not controlling all the finances. I think both partners need to be involved in that process and both feel comfortable moving together. Because as I mentioned, that helps align your goals and your values. You need to understand where both partners are coming from, and then you can make more informed decisions for yourselves. And that then impacts your well-being and all sorts of positive things. So conversations are super, super important.
When you say it impacts your well-being, I don't know if I saw this in any of your papers, but I'm sure you have an opinion on this. There might be a right way to do the finances. Like say this very financial literate person might know the exact calculations or say investment contribution that should take you to 65 for retirement.
Right.
But then there might be a relational response or relational decision. How have you seen, or what would you say, like being steadfast to the right calculations versus the right relationship decision?
Oh yeah. So that is a balance, like you said, between economic or financial well-being and relationship well-being. So it reminds me of some of like Dave Ramsey's work. So when he suggests, the snowball method of debt repayment, that's not economically optimal. You shouldn't be focusing on small debts and try to build up momentum. You should be focusing on the debt accounts that have the highest interest rate. But, some couples are willing to sacrifice the economic piece of it if it does make them motivated. And so it's really specific to the couple on what they want to do. Now, of course, I am a big advocate of, economic optimality, but I also recognize that money is not just dollars and cents. It's autonomy, it's freedom, it's responsibility, it's all these other factors. It's feelings and emotions. And so I think you also need to take that into account of your calculus of your financial decision-making.
I agree. The feelings and emotions are greater than I think most people feel. And it's making me think of another article paper that you published called You Spend How Much? And a statement that I feel has been said multiple times in relationships, which probably evokes a lot of emotion. And I took an excerpt from that paper that I want to use to cue up this question, but it just was a great statement. It says, money stirs up fierce and deeply uncomfortable emotions, emotions like resentment, envy, guilt, self-righteousness, anxiety. It is a source of conflict. We war with ourselves and with others about it. And we feel a particular pleasure in judging what other people do with their money, how they spend it, how they save it, and how they consume it. You encapsulated so much of the human experience of money. Why did you decide to put that in there so explicitly clear? What was your objective with that?
We wanted to highlight the fact that, again, money is not just currency. We're not, homo economicus. We don't operate as fully rational human beings. We have to consider the associations we have with money, the resentment, all these other pieces. And that particular article, we were really focused on emphasizing how we evaluate each other's, like our partners', you know, spending tendencies. And it could be a function of how they were brought up. It could be a function of, you know, like these childhood dreams that they had or their current desires. And they may not align with your own. And so that creates that defensiveness and, like you said, potential resentment and fear and envy. And, you know, we all like to see these stories of people, this is terrible, like drowning in debt. You're like, oh, well, at least that's not us, kind of a thing, that self-righteousness piece. Like, it's so complicated and we need to know more about it. And so Scott and I like to write very explicitly with statements like that. And so, yeah, I think we just really want to emphasize that it's not clear cut and there's a lot of nuance.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in the why we judge people so much. You know, whether it's within our coupleship, we judge another couple, we judge the neighbor, we judge a lot of people. We tend to forget someone, ourselves. What did you guys, infer of why are we constantly judging other people in their financial decision-making, especially our spouses?
You know, as soon as you started saying this stuff, I started thinking about that Taylor Swift line about I'll stare directly into the sun, but never in the mirror. Perfect for all the Swifties out there. So we are social creatures. And so have you ever heard of social comparison theory?
Yeah.
So just we look to other people as a source of information. And I think when it comes to money, there isn't necessarily a perfect path. And so you look to other people like, well, what are they doing with their money? Are they, you know, how much are they spending? How much are they saving? And I think social media perpetuates this, where you look and people are on these luxurious vacations and you think, well, I could never afford that. But then someone else is looking at you thinking, saying, wow, you have, you know, a luxury vehicle. I could never afford that. Like, we're just constantly comparing. And a lot of this is visible, you know, through social media. And then our partners are arguably one of the adults we spend the most time with in our lifetime. And so we're inevitably going to be judging. It's kind of like, reminds me of like cell phones. Like as soon as I put my cell phone down, I like lay into my husband for being on his cell phone. It's the same thing with spending. Like I spend on this, but like I'm going to blame them for this other thing. And so I think we're just constantly trying to figure it out and learn about ourselves by judging others.
Hopefully we are learning about ourselves at some point.
I hope so too.
I found it interesting how you talk about how just observing how our partner spends money or interacts with money influences how then we start to, I guess, think and make decisions as well. Can you touch on how much of an impact does that actually have?
I think it has a lot of an impact. And I think it can go in one of two different ways. So if you see your partner like spending a lot, let's say, it might license you to do the same. And you say, oh, well, if they're spending, you know, a little bit more freely, well, then maybe I can too. But it could also go the other way where it leads into compensatory mechanisms. So like if I see my partner spending a lot, I might think, oh, well, I better like reel them in or pull back my own spending. And so we're constantly trying to find, equilibrium. And so I think our partner's spending almost becomes an anchor for our own spending.
And, you know, I guess whether that's for harmony to the relationship or not, we're doing it. When you see all the nuance, like that paragraph that I introduced, all the deep-seated emotions that we have with ourselves when it comes to financial decision-making and with our partner, can we even get this right? Or is it just doomed and it's going to fail and we're going to have to just learn how to have a life of coping?
It is not doomed. Luckily, with all things, I think it can improve with work and a goal of working together and understanding that there are going to be setbacks. You know, like, oh, I went over budget this month, you know, but guess what? There's next month. And so there could be these setbacks, but I think, you know, recognizing that it's okay to make what you might perceive as mistakes, but you keep going and you stay united. One finding I was going to mention earlier that could be relevant here in terms of talking about money is I have some new work suggesting that people think, or I should say partnered people think, that talking about money is going to be worse than it is. So we ran various diary studies where we invited couples to have a financial conversation and we asked them to rate their anticipated benefits from it. We called it hedonic benefits. So like, how much is this conversation going to bring you together? how close are you going to feel with your partner afterwards? And then we had them have the conversation and followed up with them the next day. And turns out that conversation ended up much more positively than they anticipated. And so I think that there's this, you know, this fear. We think it's going to be more uncomfortable than it really is. And that can be a potential barrier. And so we're trying to work at, you know, getting people to talk about the quote, hated F word, right? It turns out it's not as bad as people think.
I one time heard a gentleman explain kind of what you're talking about here, but how our mind creates these stories, how things are going to be so scary and we can't do it, so we avoid it. And he likened it to, he's like adults scare themselves by drawing a picture of a dragon and put it above their bed. And they forget they did it. And then they go to their bed at night and get scared by there's a dragon in the room, but they drew the dragon. And it's making me think of this, just how, yeah, we tell ourselves these stories, probably largely by our own fears about the hated F word conversation around finances. Do you think that going back to that financial control conversation we had earlier and the power that confidence has, do you think having these conversations and realizing that they're not as bad as I thought, then gives the coupleship or the partnership more confidence in, I guess, all domains of these financial decision-making domains?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So talking gives you confidence because there's transparency. I have all of the information that I need. And I think talking about it gives you a sense of control because all that information is out in the open. And then that helps you move forward together and be tolerant of, you know, small setbacks because you have that more confidence and that helps you weather the storm.
So without diving too deep into your own story, but I can imagine doing this work, because like we said, it's relevant to everybody. How, if anything at all, has it helped you? And again, whatever comfort level you have, helped you navigate this war, to use your words, that we all are encountering?
Right. So funny story, when it comes to, we call it debt account aversion. So consumers have the tendency to want to close small accounts out because it feels good instead of focusing on the accounts that have higher interest rates. And so I was in the middle of paying off my student loans. And I remember going to my husband, his name is Nathan. And I was like, hey, let's just pay off this one and just close it out. And we don't have to worry about it. He's like, Jenny, what is your research? And I thought, oh, he's right. I should know better than this. And so, you know, even I'm susceptible to some of these biases because I wanted to feel good. So I'm going to go ahead and do this. I think it's also made me pay more attention to finances in terms of, you know, so my husband and I have joint accounts, but we have separate credit cards. And so, you know, I will pay for different things and then we're still pulling it from the same joint pool of resources. And I'm checking that more. And then we talk about it. I'll be like, hey, I noticed this really large charge. Like, what is that? And so we can talk about it. And so we try to make an effort to revisit it as much as possible. And so I think my work has really emphasized to me the importance of being on the same page with stuff, because watching other people and like my parents growing up, like I just know that, you know, it's really important. We want to be on the same page.
Through all these conversations that I have, communication and transparency seem to be one of the most universal beneficial things that we can do when it comes to our money conversations. And I like how you say it. You were talking about how we often think it's going to be worse than it is. Mm-hmm. So you guys have joint bank accounts now. Earlier, you talked about how you weren't sure, but I guess you guys did join them.
I wasn't sure. It turns out research shows.
Who knew? It's my own research. Another area that you research, and it might be a result of not enough conversations or hiding conversations, is financial infidelity. Mm-hmm. I've had brief conversations of financial infidelity on the podcast. I'd like to dive into your research in this topic. One of your papers has a great definition for what financial infidelity is. Can you share what is financial infidelity?
Yeah, so we define it as having two components. The first component is that it's intentionally engaging in financial behavior that you expect will be disapproved of by your partner. And the second piece is then you actively conceal it. So as an example, you know, one time I did this, admittedly, and now we use it in our talk. So like, Jenny's the face of FI. And so I went to a hair salon and I saw the bill and I was like, oh, whew, that's really high. And so I then made a choice to use my private credit card, to which he does not have access to line items. And then I used that. So I, you know, spent more than I thought he would find acceptable. And then I actively concealed it. And so that is the definition. And it spans various domains. And some people will ask, well, what about saving? What if I'm saving secretly? Still financial infidelity, if you think that, because what it implies mistrust. Like, why aren't you telling your partner that? We spent a lot of time in that paper defining the boundaries of it. Like, what is it? What is it not? But those are the two dimensions that we landed on.
And I appreciate that. I think it gives a good idea of the intentional hiding part that I want to focus on. Now, I've had a conversation with individuals in the past who have said, yeah, I'm hiding it. And I know that's bad, but it's because this person's unreasonable and they're the bad ones. If this got presented to you, what would you say? Because I've heard this. I don't know if it's defensiveness or if there's some reason for, there's some logic there. What would you say?
Oh, I love that. So we never delved into the motives, like why people are doing it. But we do find some correlations with things like Machiavellianism and entitlement. So if you're higher in psychological entitlement, you're more likely to engage in these behaviors because you feel like you don't have to justify it. But then there's also like, I don't need to tell you what I'm doing. You know, I'm going to do what I'm going to do kind of a thing. But then there's that also the piece of the compensatory, like, well, I know, you know, he's going and gambling at the racetrack, so I'm going to go ahead and splurge some. And so there's that piece as well. So I do think some of those dynamics definitely happen.
Interesting. An example that I was thinking about is someone had a whole bunch of tickets and various expenses that I think were higher than normal. And the other individual then did some spending and justified it and hid it, but then it got found out. And the justification was, well, you spent it over there, blah, et cetera. So it's so interesting how our minds can justify. And it's interesting how you bring up entitlement there.
Yeah. And it also reminds me of a paper. So it's work in progress. It's not published yet, but we look at the dynamics within a couple. So when both partners are high in the propensity to engage in FI versus low versus an imbalance. And we find suggestive evidence that if partners are aligned on this trait, they're better off than when they're misaligned. So, and I think about this just intuitively, like if I know that my partner and I are both going over budget, it almost doesn't have the negative like relationship satisfaction piece to it because we're both doing it. Or if neither of us are doing, of course, that's probably pretty good, but it's this misalignment. It's when one partner is doing it and the other isn't that really creates the negative implications for, we looked at two things, financial well-being. So saving, you're saving less money because you're not united. And then second, you're less happy in the marriage. And so there's definitely these dynamics, but on average, I should say that most people are relatively low in their propensity to engage in financial infidelity, but that could be self-report, right? People aren't admitting it. It's really hard to study this, to be fair.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you say most people are low, but it's self-report. And I wonder how low it would actually be. Just having a lot of real conversations with people, I feel like there probably is a lot more happening. Or you do talk about in your paper, like you called it discrete spending. So maybe just, can you touch on the difference between financial infidelity and discrete spending? The names themselves, I would self-report to discrete spending if I had to self-disclose because it feels better.
Right. Well, and I think that's part of it is people, like kind of what you were saying, people justify it to themselves, like a mental account of discrete spending. Well, that's okay. So then they can kind of go on with their day, no big deal. But financial infidelity has this negative tone to it. Discrete spending, the way that we're talking about it in the paper, is still an example of financial infidelity. So as an example of this, you know how Amazon, when you purchase things, sometimes it'll ask you if you want to have the item packaged in an Amazon box or its original packaging. If you are higher,
I didn't even know.
Yeah,
maybe they don't do it in Canada. I don't know.
This is an option in the United States, at least. And I know that we find that people that are higher on our scale, so we developed a scale to measure financial infidelity proneness. People who are higher, they're more likely to take the discrete option of like the Amazon package.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because you want to hide it. Like, let's say I just bought a really expensive, you know, pair of boots. Put that in an Amazon box because then I can hide it from my partner versus like, it's like the brand logo all over the box. There's no hiding it.
So Amazon is responsible for this, hey?
Yes. We actually screenshotted that in our paper. We're like, look, this is a real thing that's happening. Like some companies facilitate financial infidelity.
Yeah. Huh. And it goes back to this conversation about our financial decision-making. I mean, they don't happen in a vacuum, so to speak. Like our partner, how they spend influence it. Amazon's packaging influence it. So many exterior, I guess, stimuluses impact our financial decision-making. It's really mind-boggling, actually.
Mm-hmm. No, it's definitely a lot. I'm tenured track, so I have a full career ahead of me tackling various ways that our financial decisions are not made in a vacuum.
So let's talk about why do you think, and we've kind of been touching on this, but why do you think people engage in this financial infidelity and what impact have you observed it has on the relationship?
So I think in terms of the impact, in our first paper, we're agnostic about the level of harm. We kind of argue that it has the potential to cause harm, but it could vary depending upon the relationship. So for example, you know, if one partner spends at Starbucks and the other doesn't, that might represent financial infidelity to one couple, but not to another. And so we're agnostic to the degree of harm, but we still say there's a potential because it implies mistrust. And so in our next paper, we're looking at some of those dynamics, and we do find that just the more discrepant you are, it predicts lower savings, lower happiness in the relationship. So there are some implications there. And can you remind me of the first question?
It was kind of like why and the impact. Like, why are we doing this?
Yeah, well, because we can.
It's a loaded question. Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's a lot of like mobile banking. I mean, we can, you know, do these sorts of things. But I think if I had to guess, it's a way of gaining control. Because it's something that I can do for myself or like sometimes it's involved with kids. Like I'm spending way more than I should on my baby boy right now, right? And so I'm going to conceal that. So it's a way of gaining control. I think we also find suggestive evidence of like financial harmony as part of it. Like if you're not happy in the relationship, it could, you know, maybe prompt you to engage in these behaviors again as a way of regaining control. And so I think that there's almost like that compensatory piece. Like retail therapy. We tend to do that when we're sad because we're trying to regain control.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. You're in the marketing department and you're really blending a lot of the emotional aspects of money into your research. What continues to draw you into this more human side of money, despite one may assume based on your resume and your department that you might focus just on the more economic side, I'll call it?
So my undergrad, I did psychology and human development, and then I did a master's degree in social psychology. So I've always had that social psychological lens and using, you know, dyadic data and thinking about relationship science. But then marketing is really the blend of economics and psychology, well, consumer behavior in particular. And so I think the big reason that, you know, I ultimately decided to go into marketing instead of like social psychology was I really care and want to help people directly and like work with, you know, teaching these business students who go out into the world and do all these things to think about this stuff. You know, money is not just, you know, maximizing your ROI, you know, it's all these other things. And so I love talking to financial planners. You know, they work with couples face to face and we talk about these sorts of things and like, you know, think about interventions and just really helping people make more informed choices in the marketplace because there's a lot of information out there. Some of it's better than not. And so if I can provide research-based insights, then I hope that, you know, can facilitate consumer well-being.
Say someone's listening and, you know, that last part really influence consumer well-being. If this is the desired outcome that we're trying to navigate towards, and I think most of us are, if they're having trouble with imbalance of decision-making around finances, maybe they're engaging in themselves financial infidelity or they assume their partner is or versions of financial infidelity because we don't want to admit it's financial infidelity because it's such a hard word. Discrete spending, there's the marketing coming out. We need a new word for that. We've talked about communication and transparency. Are there any other things that you would suggest based on your research, what relationships and individuals within those relationships can start to do?
I would say be honest with yourself and think about, journaling. I mean, I always hate when people are like, oh, you should journal about this, but it's a thing, you know, and like actually write some of these things down. One of the exercises that I know my financial planner once mentioned to me was to have people write down their values. Like, what are really the values that drive you? You know, for some people, it's fun, it's spontaneity, it's security, you know, and so kind of write that down and then take stock of, you know, is the financial behavior that I'm engaging in helping me reach those or fulfill those values? And then, you know, maybe both partners do that exercise and then it provides, and I keep saying conversation, but then it provides a platform, you know, trying to think about these sorts of things. Another thing I like to ask people to consider is their first memories of money. Like, when do you remember learning about it? And chances are there's something there that is still present today. And I find that fascinating. I don't study that dynamic yet, but I want to delve more into that as well. Because like you said, the stories we tell us, there's a reason for it, right? It's coming from somewhere. And so I think building more awareness on maybe, you know, why you're spending, because it's probably not about the item. It could be about something else, right? It's celebration or some other sort of thing. I think having that insight can then help you live your life in a way that's aligned with those values.
I think that's very insightful. Yeah, we know just how much those early memories and experiences, like you even talked about watching your parents with two different perspectives, have influenced us. You said you haven't studied it yet. If you had to make an assumption of, this is a big assumption, but if we look at individuals engaging in financial infidelity, if we look at what is the underlying need, what would you assume might be an experience or memory that they're drawing back from their childhood?
I would say security. So yeah, like I said, big assumption. I'm thinking of a scenario where if you grew up lower income, money was very scarce. You weren't sure if you were going to have, you know, clothing the next season or food on the table. You then grow up kind of feeling like money is scarce. It's this thing that's elusive. You may not have it tomorrow. And so when you get it, you want to spend it almost. Or conversely, you want to, you know, save it up, save, because it could always be gone. It also can bring about shame, right? And then you're afraid to share this part of you with your partner. So yeah, I think it can go in a couple different ways, depending upon those early, and a lot, you know, socioeconomic status plays into this. And yeah.
Yeah, I think I really appreciate that, like security and the shame you said. And why is because we can look at this as like, you're wrong. You know, which is, I guess, shame-based in itself. Like you committed financial infidelity, you're wrong. But I like this thinking that, you know, we're seeking an underlying need that might not be met underneath. And it might help people, I guess, have more relational conversations when these things come up, as opposed to getting extremely mad. And
yeah, and this is a super vulnerable thing, right? So like if you are engaging in financial infidelity or you suspect your partner is, one thing that I highly recommend is almost taking a step back and getting curious about it. No judgment. I'm trying to understand, you know, how does it make you feel? Are there certain times that you find yourself doing this more often than not? And I think by getting curious, it takes the stigma away. And then you can actually understand, like you said, what's the real need that's driving this?
I feel like that's where your journaling comment really could come in before you blow the lid off and get angry.
Because it is easy, let me tell you. I've been in that situation. It's easier for me to say this than to do it.
Yeah.
It is for everybody. But so there's this thing, the hot, cold empathy gap, if you've ever heard of this. Like money tends to put us in a hot state. We need to take a step back to get into a cold state. And then that's where we can think a little bit more clearly.
We just got a cold bath then. Maybe that'll take away the hotness. Cold bath seems to fix everything nowadays. Or cold plunge, sorry.
Oh, yeah.
That was my internal joke to myself that it seems like cold plunging resolves everything in the world right now. But money, it influences so many things that we've been talking about, is hiding expenses, financial control. You've also done some research on how income can influence our pro-social. Was it spending or view as around money? Maybe just touch on that research, because I found it really interesting how you're linking income, not just money, but like your income to pro-social spending.
So yeah, so I have some work looking at couples relationship satisfaction with financial decision making, but I also have this other body of work of how we judge other people's behavior as a function of their income. So it's a person perception paper.
Okay.
Yeah, where we look at other people, and if they are lower income, we don't really see them as extra moral for engaging in pro-social behavior, but wealthier people we actually see as more moral for engaging in these sorts of behaviors.
Really?
Yes. So that is a whole other topic of conversation because, yeah, I've got a whole thing on like how we judge other people for their income.
Wow. So someone I was talking to said a little statement about your paper on that one. And I didn't go into the paper. The other ones I was reading, and that is fascinating to me. So are you saying that we have this idea, and I know you said it's a whole nother conversation, but individual like, say, Bill Gates, who has plenty of money, with his pro-social spending, we view as more moral than, say, someone who's lower income, who is giving probably a much larger percentage of their overall income, but they're mm-hmm. less moral for doing so.
And I should say lower income and receiving government benefits, aka like welfare recipients. And part of it is people assume like, well, if you have all this extra money to give, maybe you should allocate that towards something else like education or other things. And so it elicits anger. And it goes back to this idea that we judge everyone. Like we're just constantly judging everyone for what they're spending, what they're not spending. And we do it as a function of their income.
That is interesting. I'm going to go back to the relationship side on this judging income. How have you observed, if anything at all, within relationships, income levels, and the correlation between how much financial control or decision-making they have within a relationship?
You know, we have never explicitly looked at what we would call differential income. So like when one partner earns a lot more than the other, like how that can shift the balance of power. I will say I've read some stuff in some work in sociology, and I think there's a few papers that are in the works that I've seen at conferences lately starting to look at this, but the higher earning partner does tend to expect greater control of the finances, right? Even if the other partner is still contributing maybe in non-financial ways with like caregiving responsibilities and things like that. There's also differences as a function of which partner is earning more as gender. So there's this really fun paper, I shouldn't say fun paper, but a really interesting paper published a few years ago that looked at situations where women are the chief wage earner in male-female couples. And they find that the partners will tend to maintain multiple pools of resources to allow a male partner to feel like he's controlling, like, hey, I paid for the mortgage kind of a thing. So there's this, yeah, there's so many interesting things of this domain, but in my own work, I haven't explicitly looked at that, but there are some dynamics for sure.
Always got to prop them up, hey?
Yep. You need to feel like you're contributing in a traditional male way, right?
Yeah. Wow, that's unfortunate. I'm sure you're continuing to be curious yourself in terms of where your research is going. What is piquing your interest the most lately?
I think one of the things that I've been noodling on, or a couple things, one is the flow of income through the relationship. So like if money goes first into separate accounts and then up to a joint, or like starts in the joint and then goes to separate, because right now, like I have that paper where we look at just one structure or another, but what if you have a blend? Like, is an optimal situation, like if you're both joint and then, you know, goes to separate, would be one idea. The other thing that I've been thinking a lot about is prenups. The ship has sailed for my own marriage, of course, but it's this interesting thing where it makes economic sense. It's very rational, but yet we are very vehemently against that idea because it contradicts emotions, right? It's almost like it's signaling to your partner that you don't think this is going to last. And so, you know, what are some of the implications of prenups? Because again, on the one hand, it's economically optimal, but relationally, maybe not. And so like, who are the people doing this? You know, how does it work out for them, et cetera? And then, yeah, the financial conversations, we're pushing that more and more now to understand those dynamics and like what people are actually talking about. More financial infidelity work. So yeah, I've got a lot of stuff that I'm tackling right now, and I look forward to kind of seeing how it all shakes out in the upcoming years.
Yeah, both of those are really interesting. Is when you talked about I'm thinking about the flow of money. It's also who decided how the flow should work, and did that impact? Like, what was their? I guess who decided they get to decide that?
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah, this like chief financial officer of the household. and like how responsibility shifts over the relationship lifetime, so to speak. Like, you know, partners kind of start out by actually allocating responsibility to the partner that essentially has more time. It's not necessarily the more knowledgeable partner, and how that shifts. Like, you know, so my husband and I, for example, were graduate students at one point. You know, we didn't make very much money. We were pretty equal. But then, you know, I became a marketing professor and he went into real estate development. And like, all of a sudden you have more resources and there's more complexity. Children, that would be another topic I have not delved into, but how people spend through their children. Been talking about like healing childhood wounds. So that's a whole nother topic that I think would be fascinating to delve into.
That really is. The kids needed it.
Oh yeah, you know. That's for them.
Yeah, it's for them.
An American Girl doll? Oh, that's for my daughter. Yeah.
It is just fascinating the influence money has on all these interpersonal relationships that we have. And I think it's wonderful the research that you're doing. So a question that I end with is a question I think that steps away from the economic right conversation, but we'll see how it goes with you. Let's imagine that you are at end of life and it doesn't matter how old you are. You find yourself sitting on a front porch looking out at a view that brings you complete peace, ease, and contentment. And you decide to bring out your journal and write an entry as to what you learned to have a happy, healthy relationship with money. And this letter, this journal is going to be given to your kids' kids.
Oh, that's tough. If I had to write one thing in that journal, I think I would say, don't forget to have some fun. And I know that's kind of sounds silly, but you know, we get so caught up in saving, save, but to what end? And so I don't want my kids to lose sight of enjoying life. It doesn't have to be, you know, blowing a lot of money, but like just enjoying yourself a bit too. Like, I mean, it's a balance between working hard and playing hard.
Thank you. I appreciate that because yes, that balance and finding that balance is, I guess, a lifelong journey. However, I feel like the rewards are definitely worth it. As we come to an end here and we've been navigating the financial control, who has power to make the financial decisions, to financial infidelity. Do you have any final comments that you'd want to say to listeners based on the work that you've been doing? And your work is often shared through written form. So this is an opportunity through a verbal form to share your message with our listeners.
Oh, for sure. So if I was talking to the listeners out there, I would say a couple things. One is don't lose sight of yourself and your partner, right? Like you're in this together. If you are partnered, and just to have that insight, like knowing yourself, and it's okay to, you know, have what you feel might be a setback, because that setback might be an opportunity for growth in terms of your financial well-being. And so don't lose sight of those things. We might have those day-to-day struggles, but keep your eye on that big goal.
Yeah, I think thank you for that. Those setbacks can be deceiving where I feel like people recognize that, no, this is burning. Everything's going to be ruined, but to your point, that's an opportunity for growth.
And I firmly believe when a door closes, there's going to be another that opens. And, you know, we have setbacks for sure. And so just to keep your eyes on the prize, so to speak.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share with our audience your research and coming here today. You have a website. So if people are interested in the research you're doing or other things you're doing, where would you point them towards online?
Yeah, so check out jennyjinolson.com. So you can find links to my papers there as well as my CV and contact information. I'm also on Twitter/X, as I believe my handle is jennyjin18, and happy to chat.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it. Thank you for tuning in this week to the Most Hated F-Word podcast. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Olson as much as I did. Money and couples, such a dynamic conversation. I'm glad we tackled it today. If you've been enjoying these conversations, I'd like to ask you a favor. You can support the show by heading over to Apple Podcasts and leaving a review. Or please send this episode to a family, friend, or colleague. Until next week, have yourself a good one.
I'm on a mountain without a top. My wealth is measured in how I spend my time. But now I write freedom story with every breath inhaled. Money is not the boat of life, it's just a wind in the sail.